everybody. This is 155 of Breaking Tape with Boucher and Barry. I am your host, Jeff Boucher, with me, my man, my friend, Barry Rose. Barry, we are going to break new ground here today on Breaking Kayfabe. Would you agree with that?
I would 100% agree with that, Jeff.
So would you say I'm 100% correct?
I'd say you're 100% correct.
Check. So today on our show, we are breaking new ground in the sense that for the first time in the history of the show, and Barry, quite frankly, and the society we live in today, I have to say that I'm a little ashamed of the fact that after 155 episodes, we're finally getting to an American woman's wrestling match for the match of the week. So we are nothing if not diversifying ourselves, breaking new ground. Today, we are going to be featuring a match from June 8th, 1988 in Tokyo's Korakuen Hall, one of my favorite all-time wrestling venues, as the Jumping Bomb Angels, Itsuki Yamazaki and Norio Tatano, take on American women, Judy Martin and Leilani Kai, for the WWF tag team show. I think they were WWF at that point. They hadn't switched to the WWE. So the WWF tag team titles are on the line. We will also be featuring an interview with Judy Martin of the Glamour Girls.
What?
Barry, I think I can speak for you when I say she is just an absolute peach. Just one of the nicest people you'll ever meet in the wrestling business.
Yeah, and you and I had both met her. You met her at a convention, and I met her at a convention as well, and then I was able to have lunch with her. And she really was, but it's almost in passing. And then as we were going to interview her, Nick reached out, and Nick said, you know, Judy might be the nicest person I've ever met in my life. And I was like, wow! And you know what? He's 100% right. Jeff, you just said something, and this is interesting, because the second you said it, my mind started racing and I started thinking. So you said Korakuen Hall was one of your favorite wrestling venues of all time. What is your number one pick? What would be your favorite building you've ever been in to see professional wrestling?
It would either be Korakuen. I had a lot of fun in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the arena there where I saw the Crockett Cup, St. Petersburg, where we, Dave Flaherty and I went over to see a card over there.
Was that at the Bayfront, Jeff?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Bayfront was a fantastic venue. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'd probably be one of those three. I was also in the Sumo Hall, and I was also in Budokan, which were great buildings when I was in Japan. But of those three, I think Korakuen, because Korakuen's a more intimate venue. I think I like that best.
Yeah, that's good too. So it's a tough one for me. I was in Arena Mexico, I guess, about 2.5-3 years ago. And I was really blown away by the atmosphere. And the building itself is an older building. It's not anything glamorous. But at the same time, there are murals on the walls of all the luchadors that have appeared there. There's people, there's all types of T-shirts and all types of swag being sold. And there's just a general atmosphere to that building, which I like. I think if I was looking at my favorite building that I regularly saw professional wrestling would be the Miami Marine Stadium. And when the weather was good, it was an outdoor stadium, and the stage is actually on a barge in the water. So the seating is on land, and then the stage is on a barge in the middle of the water. And whenever they had wrestling there, it was always exciting because you were almost guaranteed that at least one heel was going to go swimming in Biscayne Bay.
I was fixing to say that didn't Masao Hattori take
Masao the Hattori? Yeah. Yes, and there are great photos that Pete Lederberg has of, and I think it was Steve Kern and Mike Graham that actually threw Hattori in there. I want to say Tiger Conway Jr. went in, and a few guys went in, but it was such a unique venue to see wrestling. And if the weather was great, really there was nowhere nicer to be. I mean, you're literally on Biscayne Bay watching professional wrestling. It was fantastic. And it's still around. I don't think it's operational any longer. I know there's been a restoration project in the works for years. I think it's been deemed a historical site, but I know that it's still around, but I don't think anything's actually happened. Certainly nothing in the last 6 or 7 months has happened there.
So, okay, besides that, on the show, we're also going to be recognizing a recent death in the wrestling business, that being of Jerry Brown, famously part of the Hollywood Blondes, the original Hollywood Blondes, with Buddy Roberts and Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I will be discussing merchandise available for sale by an old friend of the show and a friend of Barry's, that he has available for that. I know you're going to want to talk about that, Barry. I will be discussing recently. I got a chance to watch the new Dolomite movie. I should say the new, it's been out like a year. I, you know, take forever to get around and see it. And I asked Barry in a very important question. Is this one of the all-time leaders in cursing in a movie? Sadly, I wasn't even close. I have a food-related question for Barry because I know Barry always likes that. And we're going to be discussing a couple of birthdays that are on the day that we record here of people that are near and dear to our hearts, one in wrestling and one in the movie business. Before we get to that, though, I have some sad news to report. Last week when Barry and I were getting ready, along with Lou, we were getting ready to record the show, I had received word that my my dad's younger brother, John Bowdrin, had passed away. And what had happened, Barry, just talk about a horrible, horrible chain of events. His my Uncle John's daughter, Sheila, I think that's his youngest daughter, her daughter was getting married in Texas. So my cousin Sheila was having her daughter married that day. And my other cousin, Sheila's sister, Mary Ellen, was down, I believe, with one or two of her kids at the wedding. So my Uncle John's two of his three daughters, he has eight kids, Barry. Three of them are girls. Two of the three girls were in Texas for the wedding. They did not want to tell the girls that their father had passed away because they did not want to ruin the wedding and all the events surrounding the wedding. So nobody could say anything about the fact that my uncle had passed away. There was nothing on Facebook or anything. And so I literally, as I was recording, was on the phone texting, you know, my like my father and saying, as anyone revealed the news to the two girls so that, you know, I can make an announcement. And it was literally about half an hour after we finished recording that I got a message saying that, you know, the word is out now. And I believe my cousin Terrence, who, by the way, Barry, is a member of our Facebook group.
Yes.
Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. That he announced that his father had passed away, and he wrote a very glowing tribute to his dad, my Uncle John Bowdrin. I just real quick want to tell you a quick story about my Uncle John. They lived in Cortland Manor, New York, which is I don't know how far it is outside of the city. It's a pretty fair drive, but it's not like it's in upstate New York or anything. All I know is that the Jets used to do like their fall when they go to camp before the football season. They used to do it in Cortland Manor because it was big news when Joe Namath and the Jets came there for their fall football camp. My dad and my Uncle John, for those of you that don't know it, and Barry, I don't know if you know this, they came from a family of five kids, all boys. My dad's parents were both deaf, and they raised five boys, which is it's crazy to think about now. It's even crazier to think about someone doing this in the, like, you know, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s and stuff like that, when there weren't as many resources probably available to the deaf community. My grandfather worked at the Daily News in the printing room, where, of course, just a cacophony of noise. That way it couldn't affect him because he was deaf, obviously, and so the noise didn't bother him, the printing press. But anyway, so my Uncle John was my dad's my dad was the middle child, and my Uncle John was the one that was next to him, the next youngest. And they had like a sort of a little competition between the two of them almost sometimes when I would see them get together. And the last time I saw them get together, you know, my dad had always placed his parents, as people will do, on a pedestal, you know, and he liked to make it seem not that my grandparents never did anything wrong, but, you know, there was a perfect marriage and you would never see them argue and all this kind of stuff. And so when we went up to see, we went to a family reunion and we went to see my my cousins and my uncle and aunt and stuff there. My Uncle John is sitting around and he's telling us stories about my grandfather. Needless to say that I'd never heard before about how he and my grandmother, they would get in an argument when my grandfather would come home. And of course, they both use sign language. So he'd say, boy, you'd see the sign language just flying, you know, like quicker than anyone could read because, you know, they were upset with one another. And then, so he's telling us a story about basically the fact that my grandfather was a human being. You know, he made mistakes. He did things wrong. And then he got over, you know, he and my grandmother got past it. Well, of course, this is something that none of us had ever been told. And I think my dad, he didn't get mad at his brother, but he got a little peeved that his brother was destroying this sort of illusion that he'd created of his parents, that they had never, ever had a single problem in all the years they were married. And, you know, so it was kind of interesting. And the fact that my uncle would always introduce my uncle John and my aunt Cecile, his wife, were in fact my godparents. And he used to always, whenever he'd see me, he'd always say, "Remember, I'm the good looking Bowdrin brother." And so that's how I'll remember my uncle John Bowdrin. I reach out to his son Terrence and all my cousins and his wife, my aunt Cecile, and I say that we raised an adult beverage to the memory of my uncle John Bowdrin. I appreciate Barry and Lou giving me the time to sort of recount my uncle's life, and he'll be missed. And they had a lovely funeral service for him, I believe, day before yesterday. And my cousin Terrence put on Facebook that it was a beautiful affair and a beautiful memory of a great man. And so so we remember my uncle John Bowdrin, raising an adult beverage to his memory. And now on with the rest of the show, as Ed Sullivan used to say. So before we get to our match of the week, Barry, we discussed Coracon Hall. That's where this match took place on June 8th, 1988, is the Glamour Girls, Judy Martin and Leilani Kai, versus the JBA, the Jumping Bomb Angels. Now, this was sort of towards the tail end of the program that these four women had had. This was kind of interesting, and Judy discussed it a little bit. This was pretty groundbreaking stuff for them to bring in a Japanese tag team to face some American women and have the Japanese women be baby faces, Barry.
Yeah, and it was groundbreaking, and I don't know how well it worked, because I think wrestling fans, especially at this stage, which is what, 86, 87, somewhere around there, I think they were still conditioned that if you were from another country, you had to be a heel. Obviously, if you were German, you were a Nazi. If you were Japanese, you were still throwing salt in the eyes. And that really was the way that most of the Japanese in the WWWF were always portrayed. You know, Mr. Fuji was throwing salt, Tanaka. I think even when Saito came in and they paired Saito up with Fuji, which really, if you stop and think about it, those are completely two different types of wrestlers right there. So it really was unusual. And I don't remember how well the Jumping Bomb Angels got over. They may have. I don't really recall. The astounding thing to me when I see this match, first off, is A, the Jumping Bomb Angels were a very good team. How good the Glamour Girls were. I think I was watching this at the time, but it somehow didn't resonate just how good they were as a team. And, you know, I must have seen Leilani Kai. I've seen Leilani more than I've seen Judy Martin work. And I probably saw Leilani Kai work because she started off in Florida maybe some 50 odd times. And, you know, I think there was a pattern with women's wrestling in the U.S. in the 70s. I think there was a select style that they were using, a certain moveset. The referee generally got involved. You know, it's a lot of times the women's matches in the 70s, and I guess going into the 80s at some point, they were viewed a lot of times as comedy as well. And then you get this where you get, you know, these four women who seem to be working very stiff. Am I right about that, Jeff? Like they?
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, they really seem to be laying it in. So to see like Leilani Kai in this type of match, and she excels, as does Judy, completely just different than I think what we were used to of that, you know, the fabulous moolah style of women's wrestling. To that end, too, and, you know, as I watch this, was this the best women's wrestling in the U.S. from a U.S. standpoint, as far as having U.S. women in a match? You know, and where I think where I'm getting at is everybody knows that moolah had a stranglehold on wrestling in the United States, for women's wrestling in the United States. And when you see this match, moolah was never, I never saw moolah as a very, very good worker. I know that politically she certainly did extremely well for herself, but at the same time, I can't sit here and say I ever saw a match with the fabulous Moolah that I was like kind of like, wow, that's unbelievable, where I was just taken aback by it. And, you know, I know that this is going to be touched on in the interview with Judy, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of stories about Moolah out there, and there are a lot of people that will defend her. They'll defend her to the death. And there were people that will come out and tell you, you know, I saw it. I know that she did a lot of these things. But I think one thing that a lot of people can agree on is that she definitely oppressed a lot of the female wrestlers in the U.S. And she had a falling out with a lot of these women. Judy and Leilani Kai are two prime examples. But as workers, Judy and Leilani are light years above Mula. And it, to me, it's, you know, I'm not quite sure that you could have this same kind of scenario currently because it's so blatantly obvious. But there had to be a lot of frustration, you know, and maybe there wasn't. Maybe the fact that the paycheck showed up, and maybe that is the ultimate goal. But there had to be a frustration amongst some of the women wrestlers with Mula because they were working head and shoulders above her where she was at. So for her, at, you know, at age like 87 or whatever she was, to keep herself as champion, you know, when you've got women like Judy Martin and, you know, you've got Leilani Kai and others that are out there, it had to be frustrating, Jeff. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and when you listen to the interview that we did with Judy today, you know, as Barry said, that while Mula wasn't necessarily a great worker in the ring, she was probably one of the all-time great workers outside the ring.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with her, dare I say, Machiavellian maneuvering. You know, we sit there and we've talked about guys that we essentially feel like work the promoters, especially, you know, you talk about places like WCW or the WWE when it's a more of a corporate environment and guys who are able just to manipulate things behind the scenes. And, you know, I don't need to go over, I think everyone knows who we're talking about here, but in her own way, Mula was every bit as good at the, you know, behind the scenes and outside the rings, maneuvering and mechanizations to keep herself over, to keep anyone, you know, that, you know, I mean, think about when Wendy Richter got over huge as the woman that, you know, was part of the Cyndi Lauper thing. And then, you know, all of a sudden that push just faded, you know, like right out of view. And, you know, for a lot of different reasons, but, you know,
Jeff, there was this screw job in the middle of the ring.
Yeah.
Like there, you know,
the spider lady,
the spider lady. Exactly. So it's, I mean, you know, and everybody talks about is Sean and Brett, and I realize it's generational, but that occurred on television. And I'm not sure at the time when we were watching that we even knew what we were seeing. We had to read about it in hindsight and try to figure it out. But, it also begs the question, look, apparently as the story goes, and this is probably some rhetoric coming from either Mueller or McMahon, Wendy had a huge head on her shoulders, literally actually had a huge head on her shoulders, but figuratively as well, because she had let a lot of this go to her head. She thought that she was bigger than everybody else. She thought, according to the stories, she was the female Hulk Hogan at the time, that she was responsible, and they decided that they were going to just take her down. But it does beg the question, why was this done in the ring? Why wasn't this just done off camera? Like, why didn't Dr. D. David Schultz just go up and rough her up and say, give me back the belt and give it to Mula? And Mula wins the title in Rio de Janeiro. Like, why did it have to be done in the ring? That part to me doesn't really compute, doesn't make a lot of sense. But Wendy Richter was another one. I you know, better than Mula, you know, like better than, yeah, Mula.
Well, yeah, that's not a real high bar.
I know.
And, but so anyway, so we have this match that took place. This was after, I believe, the Glamour Girls had defeated JBA for the belts. Am I getting that timeline right? Who was the champ going in this? Was it JBA or Glamour Girls?
This is confusing, Jeff. I think it's JBA because the ending to me was really confusing. And then I had to go read the comments, and I got to say, YouTubers, you didn't help. You didn't help at one fucking bit. Right. I'm more confused now after reading the comments than I was beforehand. So, yes.
Yeah. So what did you think of the match, though?
I did. I liked the match a lot. I was so impressed with all four women, but especially the Glamour Girls, and a lot of it because we never saw this style of wrestling from these women in the U.S. So I was kind of blown away with that. It's an excellent match. There's really no flaws. What I like about this match too, it's 60 miles an hour right out of the gate. There's no rest holds. They're not sitting around, and they're out there and they're working stiff, which is what I like. You know, I felt it. Leilani Kai puts a couple of kicks in one of the bellies of one of the jumping bomb angels. And even I'm like jumping going, oh, I felt that. So they, you know, they must have said something or communicated it somehow. Lay it in. Be a little, you could, you know, you can rough us up a little bit. Let me ask you a question too. Who were the masked women at ringside?
You know, when Dump Masumoto was over as the big heel with the All Japan Women, she was always accompanied to the ring by various masked girls. I don't know if it was anyone in particular. It might have just been like the younger girls, you know. I mean, there were women that wore masks that were very specifically identified. I think, you know, like Crane Yu and other women. But I don't know if these, essentially, they were probably the young girls that they didn't want to expose their identity. And, you know, that way they just have them at ringside and they're, you know, they're getting the education of watching these four veterans work at it and, you know, show them the way to go, much like they did. And they did that in All Japan, New Japan and other promotions too. And quite frankly, it's an idea I think that other promotions should, you know, could avail themselves of the opportunity to do. But no, I thought this was a really good match. Was this the greatest match I have ever seen involving Japanese women? Certainly not. Not even close.
What about American women, Jeff?
No. You didn't let me finish there.
Okay.
And so, but what I was going to say was, as far as a match involving American women, I know we had Debbie Malenko went over, and I think she stayed a full year with the All Japan Women, and she became quite a good worker. And I've seen matches with her that were very good. Medusa Michelli, I've seen her have good matches with Bull Nakano and, you know, stuff like that. So if I won't say this was the best match involving American women I've ever seen, it's certainly, I'm going to say it's probably top three, you know, or, you know, one of the matches they had with the JBA in the United States, because I will say this, the JBA by this point in the feud, they'd put on a little bit of weight, and I'm not trying to body shame anybody, but when they first came to the WWE, and I want to say that was, I know it was 87. It might've been late 86. They were still lean, mean and quick and slick. And they could go for 60 minutes, a million miles an hour in the ring. But by this point, they had sort of blended in with the American lifestyle, shall I say. They had put on some weight. Something that's very interesting, at least one of them apparently smoked like a chimney. And I'm always fascinated by guys, wrestlers, whether they be women or men, who can go out and wrestle a 60-minute match or a 30-minute match, whatever. And, you know, Harley Race was famous for smoking. And I just don't understand how you can have that kind of wind and oxygen to work a match that long and be like a heavy smoker or a chronic smoker. But apparently one, if not both, of the JBAs had become that way when they went to the United States. But anyway, no, I thought it was a good match. It wasn't the greatest women's match involving American women I've ever seen, but it was certainly up there. I would say top 3 to 5, very entertaining. The crowd, of course, in Corkin Hall, always fun to watch, Barry. And they definitely add something to the match.
So Barry, I know you join me in saying that we are breaking new ground here as we have match, for the first time an American lady wrestler.
Why don't we go now to our interview,
Judy Martin. With Judy Martin. We are so happy to have you here today. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Great to hear all of you guys.
So Barry and I were talking before we started recording about the fact that we had each met you once before. I met you in Charlotte at one of the fan fest, and Barry met you up in Allentown. So we would like to discuss a little bit about your career. Barry, you about ready to go, my man?
I am ready to go too. Very excited. So Jeff, am I correct too? Is this the first female wrestler that we've ever had on the show for an interview?
I believe it is. So Judy,
groundbreaking.
You go into our Hall of Fame, Judy.
All right.
There you go.
So there's no place to start like the beginning. So Judy, why don't you tell us, did you grow up as a fan of wrestling? How did you first get interested in becoming a pro wrestler?
Well, really, my dad was a fan of pro wrestling. Him and my mom used to go to the matches in Charleston, South Carolina, and Florence, South Carolina. They used to go watch the matches when I was real little. I never thought about wrestling until I really got bored one day. Me and my cousin, and I said, what else is there to do in Columbia here? She said, well, there's a wrestling match. I said, well, really? I said, let's go see that. So we went to see that on a Tuesday night. And when I was sitting there watching, I said, God, I said, shoot, I could do that. And Blackjack Mulligan was there.
Our time frame is like what, about the late 70s here or what?
Oh, yeah. This is around about 77, around 77. I said, I couldn't figure out why everybody hated this guy, you know? I said, well, I know he's mean looking, but I said, he can't be that mean. And so when the matches and everything over with, we was leaving, and she said, well, dang, there's a lot of people standing out back there from the township. I said, well, let's go back there and see what's going on. So we went back there, and about that time, Mulligan and Dick Murdoch came out. And I said, well, shoot, there's that guy. Let me go ask him. So she said, what you going to ask him? I said, I don't know. Anyway, so I went up to running up to him. I said, hey, I said, I introduced myself. I said, hey, I got a question for you. And he said, well, I'm sorry. He said, I'm on my way out of town because we got another booking and stuff like that. He said, but I'm here next week. If you want to, you can come back. And he said, I'm glad to ask all your questions. I said, okay. So, you know, the following week came, you know, and goes, I said, okay, let's go to the matches. Linda was my cousin. I said, let's go to the matches and everything. I said, I want to talk to that guy. So went to the matches and everything. After it was over with and everything, him and Dick Murdoch was together again. And so he said, well, we're going down to pick up some beer. He said, if you want me to sit at that store. And I said, what store, you know? He said, where we all meet. And I said, well, I don't know where that is because this is my second time to the matches. He said, oh, okay. So he told me, so we went down there. And then him and Murdoch had a few minutes and they said, talk. So I asked him, could girls do this, you know? He said, girls? He said, well, yeah. He said, they got girls doing it. And then he said, you sure you won't think about this business? I said, well, sure, I can do this. So then he did a little test. Like he said, well, here, shake my hand. And he said, now squeeze. And I was squeezing with all my might. And he tell me, he said, oh, no, you're not strong enough. He said, it's a wimpy thing. So, but he told me there was a school here in Columbia and everything. And I said, okay. I said, well, I'm going to check into it. He said, all right. You know, we said our goodbyes and everything like that. So I had called Moolah. And he said, yeah, my school's right here in Columbia and everything. I said, do you mind if I can come down and talk to you? She said, well, asked me where I was working. I was working at my uncle's restaurant at the time. And she said, well, I'll come by there because I have lunch. I'll have lunch with you. I said, okay. So she came by, you know, the next week and had lunch with me and explaining stuff to me and everything. She said, well, let me know if you want to come and look at the place and train and everything. I said, okay. So I had talked to my uncle and everything. And I said, hey, you know, she told us to come out there. So we went out there and he paid for my training that same day. And I said, okay. He said, all right, go on and do what you want to do. And that's how I got into it.
Well, Judy, had you been an athlete in high school prior to this?
I just played some volleyball. But I was a farm girl, so I came off the farm, you know, dealing with tobacco and stuff like that. So,
wow, how difficult.
And I know I was, well, at first it was like, oh, man, I just couldn't seem to, like, see how people could fall, just fall backwards or fall frontward. I had more problems falling frontwards than I did backwards. Then I remember they tell me, said, just move your hands out, you know, straight. So I just fell forward and busted my nose the first thing. Oh, gosh. I said, mm-mm. So I went home and I said, I don't know where this is for me or not. So I said, no, nah, I'm going to give it 2 weeks and everything. So I gave it after 2 weeks. I said, yep, this is what I wanted to do. And I stuck with it.
was there anybody besides Moolah that was helping train you that was, you know, there at the school either a student or?
I was in the ring with Vicki Williams, Joyce Grable, Leilani, and Donna Cristatella. Those are the girls that was in the ring with me.
Okay.
Because I was only trained for about a month when we got that tour to Japan.
And who'd you go over there with?
With the six girls, it was me, Moolah.
Oh, okay. With the whole, okay, Leilani. Gotcha.
Yeah, there was us girls going over there, and we were over there for a month. And then I left from there and went to Mexico with Vicki Williams. And we were supposed to be in Mexico for 2 months. But then when we got in Mexico and everything, the people, I mean, they knew I was green and everything, but they thought I had been working at least, you know, 6 months or more. And I told them, nope, this is my second trip. And they said, really? Because they said Moolah had told them I'd been working at least a year, you know. I said, no. I said, because and Vicki Williams told them that too. She said, no, because I wasn't understanding, you know, their combination. Going into Mexico, they did combination stuff. And I said, oh, man. And I wasn't ever shown how to protect myself, you know, on the post or anything like that. My head got busted the first week I was there. And I said, ooh. And they said, well, you got to protect yourself. I said, well, tell me how. So then yeah, I trained with some of them.
Sort of on-the-job training, huh?
Yeah. So, and they said, well, Vicky and Lillian had gotten into it about something. I had no idea. I knew I'd wake up in the morning time, I'd hear Vicky on the phone arguing with Lillian and everything. And then she would go to the office in Mexico for then they I found out that they were going to keep her there. So they were sending me back home and telling me I need to get more experience. I said, okay. So when I went back to Columbia and everything, Lillian asked me what happened. I said, well, Lillian, I said, they thought I was working for a year. She said, well, you tell them you were? I said, well, no. I told them this was my second road trip coming from Japan. And she said, well, you never tell anybody how long you've been working anyway when you first started. I said, well, they pretty well knew that I was still brand new when I didn't even know some of the combinations they were giving me. And so I said, that's okay. I said, I will not go any other place until I know what I'm doing. So I was out in that gym every day with some girls, you new girls and everything, feeling my way through and asking questions and stuff like that.
You talk about Lillian, the fabulous Mula, and she is for some very polarizing with some of the lady wrestlers. What was your overall opinion of her? Did you like her, not like her, sort of in the middle? How did you feel about her?
I mean, I like Lillian from the beginning and everything. At the last, me and her, we did not get along because we didn't see eye to eye on our booking arrangement and what we needed to do for ourselves. But I mean, I respect the lady for what she did for, wrestling for herself. Now, my opinion of her was that she could always have done better through wrestling. With other girls and stuff, if she had went ahead at a certain time, retired, from the ring and just kind of, just make sure the girls were being trained the right way. And then she booked them like they should be booked and not just book a few that she liked at the time and the other girls sit around instead of her. When New York come about, every trip to New York come along, she always had herself booked on it. Instead of mostly letting the girls go out there and push, really push the girls to a different level. I think she had the opportunity to make girl wrestling at that time as big as it is now, if she would have done it correctly. Because I think she had the power to do that with Vince if they'd have sat down and, talked about it. And she really pushed the issue. And that. A lot of girls, she got along great with some girls. I mean, some girls had good experience with her. Others had bad experience with her. I mean, I would never say that, things like, when they said that she pimped people out, and that never happened with me. I cannot justify any answer for any other girls. With me, it was different. I think it was different because my family lived here in Columbia, too. When I wasn't working, I was always in the restaurant helping out, doing something else. It wasn't just dependent on staying there on her property.
So you weren't living there like some had to do.
Well, I lived on her property, but it wasn't that I had to, a lot of the girls that lived there really had just depend on the bookings they got and everything. I always had a job when I come home with my uncle's restaurant and everything. I'd go whenever I'd work there when I was, was off. Ever how long I was off, it was 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or a month or more, I always had a job. And my family lived there. So I think that was a little different, with my family living there and all the other girls, was from different other areas. So I think that made a difference with me and her. But she never really got to me as like she did some of the other girls, I'd say.
And that seems honest and fair, too. So just as a heads up, everybody, too, Judy comes to us today, compliments of our good friend Nick Massey. Nick has been doing these cabana parties, which are themed electronic, in a sense, fan fests online, where they do autograph photos. He's with different legends. He's been very successful with it. And we love Nick here over at Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. But Judy is the headliner of the next event, which is coming up really in 2 days. It's Thursday, September 24th. Got three big names. Got Jimmy Valiant, the Boogeyman, 6:00. Sean Royal, who was a guest on our show, Jeff, about a year and a half ago?
Yeah, just about.
He comes up at 8:00. And then the main event for the evening, ladies and gentlemen, our own Judy Martin is at 9:00. This is going to be really interesting, too. So, Jeff, what I think is cool about these things that Nick is doing, it's not just autograph photos and stuff like that. Judy is actually going to be bringing ring used gear with her. She's going to have a ring jacket and boots. And how cool is this? The LPWA belt from her time over in Japan is going to be up for auction. So I know that I'm going to be there because I want to see that. And if I can get that belt, Jeff, I'm going to try to get that belt. But we are looking Thursday, September 24th. It's only 2 days away, Judy at 9 o'clock. So I reached out to a female wrestling historian. His name is Chris Bergstrom, and he runs a Facebook group called The Fabulous Ladies of Wrestling. And he really, the amount of research that he's put into trying to chronicle and archive the history of women's wrestling is incredible. I really want to give him props for that. But I said, hey, do you have any questions? We're interviewing Judy Martin. And he came forth with a couple. And there was one here that I had no idea, but apparently you had a sister, Judy, named Kathy, who wrestled at one point. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah,
you're chuckling. Sister. Okay.
Well, the reason is because I didn't know she was doing that until I came off of a road trip from Japan, and I came into Atlanta. They had a battle royal in Atlanta. Mula had commented that I was going into Atlanta, and he said, and I got a surprise for you, too. I said, what? She said, oh, your sister's going to be there. I said, oh, okay, great then. And she said, she's working. I said, what? She's working. She said, oh, yeah. She's been training. I said, when did all this happen? I said, she can't do that. And when I got there, she was in the dressing room. Hey, Judy. What are you doing here? And she's like, oh, I'm wrestling tonight, too. I said, when did you think you could do this? She said, I've been doing this, you know, for about 3 weeks now. I want to surprise you. But, oh, great.
And, did she work as Kathy Martin or what was her name?
No, they named her Susan Starr that night because they had not had put her name because Mula had this thing about putting her as my, you know, me and her as sisters. And team and stuff like that. And I told Mula, I said, yeah, she might love it right now, but she's not going to stay in this. And she said, oh, yes, I am. So anyway, but she did. She worked that. She went to Trinidad with another girl and worked 2 weeks up there. And I think it was Barbados. She went there too and worked a week up there. And I got one picture with her, me and her together, that was taken at Mula's. But you know, she decided she wasn't going to get into it, do it because, you know, she didn't care for Mula. Afterwards, when she'd been around her a little bit, she didn't care for Mula.
So, well, let me jump ahead a little bit here, Judy, because I know we have a limited mm-hmm. amount of time with you. So, of course, a lot of listeners, a lot of people that subscribe to the podcast will, of course, know you best for your tag team with Leilani Kai as one half of the Glamour Girls. And you had a very famous feud to the latter part of the 80s with the JBA, the Jumping Bomb Angels, Itsuki Yamazaki and Norio Tatano. I have to be honest with you, I'm a huge, huge mark for ladies wrestling in the late 80s and early 90s in Japan. So first of all, tell us how you were contacted by going to New York to work with Leilani as part of the Glamour Girls. How did that all start out?
Well, first of all, George Grable was supposed to go with Leilani to New York because they were more like the same height. Because Lillian liked to book the girls about, you know, being the same height. So when somebody got hurt somewhere and she pulled Joyce, to go to Japan because I think somebody got hurt over there and couldn't work. So she pulled Joyce to go to Japan. And then she substituted me with Patty to go up there and work. So when me and Patty got up there, you know, to work and everything, our match was pretty good and everything. So, you know, that's when Patty says, well, let's talk to Vince about bringing in the Japanese girls. So we got a chance to talk to him and everything. And he said, okay. He went for it, you know, because Patty had talked to Jimmy Hart and everything about changing that me and her would change our gimmicks because they thought me and her worked pretty good together as a team. So Jimmy's the one that put the Glamour Girls name together, and he's the one that did the song for it, and they put us with him. And then they said, well, they would bring in the Japanese girls. And then, of course, you know, they say, well, are y'all going to be able to work with them? And Patty said, yes, you know, we will. There's no problem about us working with them. So they contact Lillian about bringing those girls over to work with us after we changed our gimmicks and everything to the, you know, to the glamour girls and stuff like that. So then they brought them over and they said they would try them for a week. Well, the first TV we did, you know, I remember us going out there and Vince says, well, I don't want y'all girls to disappoint me now. And I think we had like 6 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes on TV time. And so we just did what we did, you know, we did in Japan. The girls, of course, the girls could not speak English very good. And so we come back out of the ring. We had to match and Vince says, oh, damn, girls, that was good. And he said, well, we'll go ahead and book them. Then he told us that he would go ahead and book us for another 3 weeks, right? And so the more he booked us, the more matches got. He goes, whew. And he told us, I can't believe this. I'm getting reports coming back to us telling us that Joss's matches are better than any of the guys.
Yeah, you guys were stealing the show, huh?
They were. Yeah.
They were because this is no lie and everything. We were in a small town in a school, it was a big gym and everything. And when we was in the ring, you could barely hear yourself talk to people. They were just right on it. And they were for the Japanese girls. And the guys, we looked back there, like to where we come out of dressing, and there was a guy standing back there looking on the hillside and babyface side. And I told Patty then, I said, Lonnie, I said, look. He said, what? I said, there's hope. He said, why are you watching? I said, yeah, he's watching our match. She said, and she kept looking. She said, oh, I see him. He said, okay. So, you know, we did our thing and everything. And so when we come back to the dressing room, everything was coming down the stairways. And the guy said, y'all don't have to take all those bumps. Y'all making us look bad out there. every night we did our best to try do those guys because we figured we had to, you know, because they were main events and stuff like that. But we knew we could keep up with them and everything. And working with the Japanese girls were easy because we had already worked with them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. You had worked with JBA over in Japan before they came over to the United States.
We did single matches with them. But Patty has never done a tag with them over there. We always worked single matches with them over there. And now, but those girls when those girls come over to the States, you know, they were living on Lillian's property with us. And so they couldn't really talk English. So when we got in the ring, you know, to show them how American style was and the things we did, you know, we either had to do like scratch their arm for one thing and then, you know, scratch their head for another thing. That's something people didn't realize was happening at that time, but that's how we did our spots and everything, that they understood what we're doing without speaking it with them in there.
That's really interesting too. And I was going to ask you, with the language barrier, how would you be able to communicate if you're not speaking Japanese and they're not speaking English? So essentially it was either a tap or a scratch or something like that.
Yeah, or like a sign language.
Yeah, like sign language too. So Leilani Kai, you two obviously great friends for many years. You two are still great friends, if I'm correct. Have you ever wrestled Leilani? I looked through a bunch of results trying to see if I could find it, and I never found a match. But was there ever a period where you ever were actually working against Leilani?
Yeah, by accident. We worked a show down in Myrtle Beach. We both went down there to work a show against two girls that was supposed to be coming in from down there. Those girls didn't show up. And then the guy, the promoter coming in, he says, those girls didn't show up. I said, well, what, you know, and we told him, say, look, you know, we're still getting paid because we made the show. It's not our fault those girls didn't come. He said, then I'm going to put y'all against one another. So, hey, what you mean you're going to put us against one another? He said, that's all I can do. So now me and Patty said, I'm telling Patty, well, I'm the heel. Patty says, no, I'm the heel. So me and her's arguing who's going to heel over who's face to face and everything. So in fact, I think I have a picture with somewhere around here with me and her in the ring doing something. And we both were just ourselves out there. So the people went for it and everything. So the guy come back, he was happy with the match and everything. So.
And you got paid. But so that's what counts.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the only match. And that's the only time I've ever worked against her.
Oh, so it was only one time.
One time.
Gotcha.
So Judy, the fanboy in me has to ask, you know, as I mentioned to you before we start recording, our match of the week this week on Breaking Kayfabe is the match where you guys regained the tag team belts from the JBA and you went over to Japan. So tell me, what was it like as a wrestler from the United States going over to Corken Hall, where the Japanese women's promotion had their cards and had their matches, and seeing, and I asked this, and I'll tell you that I've actually been to Corken Hall, and I saw a Japanese women's card actually about 8 months before the match where the straps changed hands. So I know what the atmosphere is like. But for you, what was it like going over there the first time when you saw the reaction that the lady wrestlers in Japan got from the crowd of like 13 or 14 year old girls?
It was just phenomenal. I mean, it was like, God, you know, like being here in the States and not, and you see it being on a card with all males and stuff like that, and going different places and everything, then going to a place where they have all females. It was like, man, this is great, man. They should do this in the United States. And I was told Patty way back then, I said, God, this is something Lillian could do, you know, and even bring in some of the Japanese girls over to the States. I said, I think this would work if they would promote it right and, you know, do everything like they did. They could start off small, just like those. But, oh, God, the people, once the people get over there and the wrestling fans over there, I mean, you'd be walking down the street and you'd be behind you, you'd see some. The little girls coming up behind you, they were just giggling. They were scared to ask you for your autograph, but once you stopped and they would stop, you start again and they would start again. And it's just like something that you experienced. You can't really explain to you was there and done it yourself and see how they react and everything.
No, I've said before, the greatest card I ever went to was a Japanese women's card. Because of the experience, not only with the matches, but with the fans, with the way they displayed all their merchandise was like years ahead of what they were doing in the United States. So I got to ask you, and I'm kind of knowing what the answer is going to be here, when you went over there, because you went, I'm guessing more than a few times, how the promoters treated you, you know, the travel and all that kind of stuff, were you taken care of essentially?
Oh, well, yeah, we traveled on the bus with the girls. You know, they treated us just like one of those, the girls over there. The only thing that we didn't have to do was we didn't have to put up no ring. You know, we go do what we wanted to. And then, you know, to the time of the matches and everything. But, I mean, they treated us very nice. They gave us, you know, so many yen to eat on, you know, per week. And if we wanted to eat with them, we were welcome to eat with them. We had our own hotel in Tokyo there. When we was on the road, of course, everybody stayed at the same hotel. It was very nice. They were the guys on the business over there, they were very respectful of the women they had working for them too. And they treated them like this, you know, they were stars and stuff like that. You know, they was in all different things. Whenever they did something, they did it really big.
So without getting into specifics, because I wouldn't do that, but comparatively speaking, were you paid the same as you would have been when you were in the United States working a card, say, in the WWF? Was the pay better? Was it less? Was it the same? How did that work out?
Well, the pay was back then was $500 a week. And they paid for your food and they paid for everything, your food and all. And you were generally over there for... 8 weeks. You were generally over there for 8 weeks at a time when you went. Now, so that was the pay that the pay was negotiated between Lillian and the promoters over there.
Sure. Do you remember how many trips you took over there?
10 or 11.
Yeah.
And Patty's was a lot more than mine. The last time we went over there with the belt, that's when we went for more money. and asked for more money, because for years we'd been going over there for $500 a week. And I told, like I told Patty, I said, I think we deserve $1,000 a week. I mean, we didn't make no, I didn't make no big adjustment, only $500 more a week. And I knew they're going to come up with it because everything was out. The girls had the belts over there and they had it already advertised and everything. So I knew they was going to pay more, because they knew the girls was coming back, but should, was supposed to be coming back with us at that time, you know, for WrestleMania. So when we got over there, the big, the promoter over there told us that Lillian had been calling every day and asking us to change the belts back. We said, no, we couldn't do that because, you know, we were changing them back into state at WrestleMania. And she called every day. And then he said, well, she said, we're changing, y'all need to change the belts back, that Vince wanted the belts changed back because he couldn't bring the girls back at this time. So that's how the belts got changed back in Japan. And also, while we were over there, we also learned that the promoters was paying Lillian $1,000 for each girl that went over there.
Funny how that works, huh?
Yeah, the promoter told Leilani that they were paying Lillian $1,000 for each girl went over. So with two girls over there, Lillian was getting, you know, $2,000 plus PC from our, on our $500. So
while she was sitting on her couch in Columbia, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the angry part with Leilani and I with Moolah, when we found out all this and stuff like that. And then especially when we come back from Japan and everything, and Pat Patterson told me to call him, you know, when we got back from Japan, when we finished up our trip from Japan, so they could give us our bookings for when we come back. So I had called him and told him, and he said, and he asked me, he said, what is all this effing thing about y'all switched the belts back? I said, well, Pat, I said, Moolah said that y'all wanted us to take the belts back because the girls coming back with us. He said, nobody said anything about y'all getting the belts back. Y'all just effing y'all's WrestleMania chance right there. And I tried to tell that, Pat, Moolah is calling. You call Japan, they will tell you that she is the one that said that the belts should be changed back. And that's the last time I heard from Pat for, like, you know, about 3 weeks, you know. And I told Patty what happened and everything. You know, she got angry, and she had did a tour to somewhere with Lillian in Malaysia or somewhere, but they didn't get paid over there. Lillian told them they didn't get paid over there too. So that was the last straw for Leilani. When she got back at the airport, he called me and told me she will never work for Lillian again. And she was telling me that, you know, all the stuff. And then I told her, I said, well, Patty, Pat had just called me and asked me when I worked with Robin. And he said he would switch me and you out working with Robin, but she had gotten the belt and stuff like that. So I went up there and, you know, I worked with Robin through Survivor Series and everything. And then I guess that right after the Survivor Series, we did a couple more, you know, road trips and stuff. And then Robin came in and told me, she says, well, they're not using us anymore. I said, what do you mean they're not using us anymore? He said, well, they told me they wouldn't be using me anymore. I said, huh? I said, well, Pat is supposed to come up here and work with you now. And she said, nope. They just told me they would not be using girls anymore for a while.
Let me ask you a question that, too. Really, the Glamour Girls and Jumping Bomb Angels kind of revolutionized tag team wrestling for women in the U.S. It was a big deal. And as we talked about, you guys were stealing the show. That was acknowledged, you know, through either the Dirt Sheets, the Wrestling Observer, or any fans that were in attendance. You guys were literally stealing the show on a nightly basis. But within the last year, the WWE crowned women's tag team champions, and they were claiming that this is the first time it's ever happened. So essentially, they went and they erased history. How do you feel about that after all the work that you, Leilani, and the Jumping Bomb Angels put into really, you know, the tag team wrestling for women in the U.S., just to have it completely erased by Vince? How does that make you feel?
It hurt, you know, it hurts knowing that we worked our butts off over there, and that we, you know, we put in our all, and even Vince would say that our matches was the best. In fact, I was looking through some paperwork the other day, and I found a check stub that says $1,000 bonus that he gave Patty and I for working with the Japanese girls for our matches outdoing the boys. And he called us at our arena one night and told us that he was giving us $1,000 bonus. That, you know, nothing would come out of that, but that was ours because of the matches we was having. Because he got all great feedback from Jay and all the, you know, the agency that was doing the bookings and stuff like that was saying our matches was the best one on the card. So it hurts knowing that he would not even acknowledge that we were, you know, we were up there as a tag team champion. That I still don't understand why he did it. Maybe because, I just don't know why he did it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a booker, actually, Jeff. That's actually Jeff's nickname, the booker. But it would seem to me that I would have brought you and Leilani in to present those titles to the winner or done something, somehow incorporate the history, because it would have made a lot of sense with that, too. So let me ask you a second part of that. If the WWE contacted you to go into the Hall of Fame, what would be your reaction to that?
Surprised.
There you go.
I mean, very surprised since they have not acknowledged us at all in the, you know, from the past and stuff like that. I would be very surprised and stuff. But then I would be also happy that we finally got at least some recognition, you know, from the past up there that we were included in. I doubt that I ever happened.
Well, you know, that's something I think putting you and Leilani in together would make a lot of sense. And, you know, they do these legacy type of Hall of Fames where they do bring in the past stars from the 80s as opposed to like 5 or 10 years ago. So it is a possibility. But I do want to give another plug, too. So if you are listening, we have one half of arguably the greatest American women's tag team of all time, the Glamour Girls. Junie Martin has been our guest today, and she's got a big event coming up just in 2 days, Jeff, today being Tuesday. On Thursday, which is 2 days away, September 24th, Junie Martin is main eventing our friend Nick Massey's Captain's Cabana Party. And essentially, he's doing an online fan fest is really what it is. There will be autographs, programs, books, all kinds of cool stuff. But Judy is actually bringing with her LPWA belt, the original ring-used belt, ring jacket, ring boots, and more. I know when 9 o'clock rolls around Thursday, September 24th, where I'm going to be, and I encourage everybody listening to be there as well.
And I also have my Glamour Girl fur coat with me.
Oh, Jeff, for Mrs. Baldrin, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's never too early to shop for Christmas.
There you go.
Well, Judy, before we let you go, and we are certainly very, very appreciative of your time today with us discussing your career. As we wrap up and say goodbye, I just have one last question for you. So you work one time with Leilani. So I'm going to take her out of the equation for this question. Over your career, who would you say is the best lady wrestler that you worked with? Someone, whether it's an American girl or a Japanese girl, that you just kind of went, wow, yeah, this woman really knows her business here.
Well, Velvet McIntyre.
Really? Okay.
Velvet McIntyre and also Princess Victoria, too. Those two girls were good. But like myself, Velvet learned from Japan, too, because Velvet and I was in Japan together. And then we also incorporated some of the stuff we did over there back over here when me and her was against one another out in Texas and stuff like that. We created our own things, you know, and just like when I saw the power bomb for the first time in Japan, when I came back over here, Velvet was the first one I did that to at a show in Texas. So okay. I would say those two girls.
Any of the Japanese girl besides Itsuki and Norio that you worked with that you thought were especially good?
Oh, Sammy. Her name was Sammy. I can't think of her. I always call her Sammy. Devil Masuda.
Devil Masami. Okay. She was very good.
And of course, and Mimi was very good. I did a lot of matches with Mimi and Remy.
Okay, that'd be Mimi Hagiwara?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So, well, once again, on behalf of Barry and our producer, Lou, we certainly want to thank you for your spending some time with us this afternoon discussing your career. And one more, Barry, as Barry's mentioned, you're going to be putting those items up and, Mrs. Baldrin may be getting a new fur coat.
There you go.
So anyway, listen, Judy, it was great talking with you.
Okay. Thank you guys for having me on. I had a good time too.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye, guys.
Barry, as I said at the beginning of the show, Judy, just an absolute peach. And, you know, she is just such a nice and wonderful person to talk to.
Yeah. Literally nicest person I have ever met. She really is unbelievable. And it's it's great too that she looks back. She had issues with Moolah, which she addressed to some degree, but she looks back on her career with fondness, you know, and you could hear that in talking to us today that she was excited to discuss, you know, these topics and discuss the Jumping Bomb Angels. And it was pretty cool learning how they actually communicated, how she and the team actually communicated. So, Judy, we hope you come back for a second time.
Yeah, it was a very fun interview and we had a lot of time.
So, Barry, one of the things we did want to talk about is one half of a, dare I say, legendary tag team, because I know they were one of the hottest tag teams in the world. When I really started becoming a wrestling fan, that was the Hollywood Blondes, managed by Sir Oliver Humperdinck. Huge, huge act in Montreal and L.A. And then they came to Florida. One half of their team, Jerry Brown, we heard the news that he had passed away. If you could just discuss the legacy of Jerry Brown in Florida.
This was, I guess, kind of a shock, and it shouldn't be, obviously. It was, I think he was 83 years old, but I think it was very sad. And losing Sir Oliver Humperdinck a few years back, and I love Sir Oliver Humperdinck. What a great, great person he was. I never got a chance to meet Buddy Jack Roberts before he passed away, but Jerry Brown was the last link to this amazing, legendary tag team, the Hollywood Blondes. And we first saw them in the state of Florida. They showed up in 1974. And they came in, and I think within 2 weeks of being in the state, they had gotten the Florida tag team titles. And they had a way of really getting heat, you know, and it was a great act because Roberts and Brown, and Roberts and Brown, most people know Buddy Jack Roberts as being one of the Freebirds, but he had a really great career prior to that. And Jerry Brown was kind of this workhorse. You know, they would get out there. Sir Oliver Humperdinck just had a great, you know, understanding of the psychology of wrestling. These guys would walk out of the dressing room, Jeff, and people were just livid. All they didn't have to do anything. People were already angry and they were already livid. They would get in the ring and Sir Oliver Humperdinck would then take the sunglasses off of them and then look at the crowd. And it was so much fun. This was an era of when going to wrestling was just so much fun. And these guys really personified tag team wrestling. And, you know, there were a lot of tag teams, you go back in the 70s and the 80s, that were kind of put together. You know, these weren't guys, take out guys like the Rock and Roll Express and, you know, the Fabulous Ones, teams that actually got in the gym and worked out and did stuff together. There were a lot of teams that were just thrown together at the last minute and put out there. Hollywood Blondes, literally, you could have taken them and put them into the 1980s, 1990s and go on. They were actually doing a lot of these maneuvers together. So we saw them in 74. They held the tag titles. They came back 2 years later in 76, also held the tag team titles. And then around 77, I believe they actually broke up. Jerry Brown took on, this is a kind of an unusual thing. Jerry Brown, he took on another partner for the Hollywood Blondes for just a few months, and it was the legitimate brother of Buddy Roberts. Buddy Roberts' real name was Dale Hay, and there used to be a wrestler named Sonny Rogers, and I think there have been two Sonny Rogers. This was the one of the mid-70s, and he was the legit brother of Buddy Jack, and he became Jerry Brown's new partner. Buddy Jack went out to Texas as Dale Valentine. I think he was the son or nephew or something, younger brother of Johnny Valentine when he was out there. But Jerry Brown kind of at that point became like a journeyman. I know he was out working out in Oklahoma. I think he started to homestead right around the Kansas City territory. And he hooked up with a guy named Ron McFarlane. And Ron was kind of a bigger guy. 6'1", maybe 6'2", but was kind of burly. He was definitely barrel-chested, a big guy, and they held the tag team titles, I want to say, in Kansas and in Oklahoma. And then around, I think it was 82, this mysterious mass tag team, the Alabama Chain Gang, showed up in the state of Florida, Jeff. Have you ever heard of these guys?
Escaped from a prison farm in Bama. Oh, yeah, I saw those guys in West Palm Beach, yeah.
What a great fucking gimmick, too. I
mean, those are gimmicks like you don't see anymore, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Prisoners. I wonder who found the side as pro wrestlers.
Yeah. That's the right. They just decided to walk off as they're doing, and they put on a couple of hoods, and they're safe in wrestling. Shit you can't do these days. That's fantastic. But I got to tell you, a lot of people will say, you know, oh, I knew it was this guy. And, you know, when Paul Jones is Mr. Florida, of course I knew it was. I had no idea who was underneath the hoods of the Alabama Chain Gang until somebody wound up telling me. I had no idea whatsoever. They were pretty good. They were entertaining. They never really made it out of prelims, mid-card at best. I saw an interview with Ron McFarlane over the last 48 hours where he was talking and he said, oh, we were brought into Florida and promises were made and we were going to be main event stars. And I don't see that because right out of the gate, they were pretty much, you know, working third match of the night, but they were entertaining and it was an unusual gimmick. They did pair them with J.J. Dillon, meaning that there could have been some plans for these guys. And that was pretty much it. I know that he drifted off into obscurity. I think he was off the radar for many years. Nobody had any idea where he was. And then I think he reconnected with Ron McFarlane and through that, wound up reconnecting with Buddy Jack Roberts and Sir Oliver Humperdinck before they passed away as well. At a fan fest in Charlotte, was that the one that you were at, Jeff?
Yes, I actually went to that and got a chance to see him. And unfortunately, that's when Buddy was, I don't know if he had throat cancer or esophageal cancer, but he was, you know, talking with the voice box. And it was very sad to see. But yeah, that was the first time anyone had seen Jerry Brown in, I want to say probably at least 15 years. Because he was somebody that no one had seen. He dropped off the face of the wrestling earth.
Yeah. And there were some stories, too, that were out there. I want to say Bill Watts spoke about it.
I was going to say, bring up the Bill Watts story. Yeah. Right. Why don't you tell the folks the Bill Watts story?
And here's the thing. I don't remember all the details, but I know that Bill Watts, there was some sort of issue, and I believe it was Jerry Brown showing up at Bill Watts' house.
With a weapon.
Allegedly with a weapon. And was upset. And Bill Watts, probably not the guy that you want to do that to. And I think that may have even been what actually caused him just to go off the radar for many years. I'm not quite sure he was booked after that. I don't remember all the details of that story, Jeff. I just remember there was something, though.
Yeah, I know there was my memory sketch on it too. There was some sort of a dispute about something. And he allegedly showed up at Bill Watts' house with a gun. There were some threats made, and shockingly, Bill Watts fired him very quickly afterwards, which is really not that big a shock, actually. Yeah, but as I said, huge, huge deal in Montreal, 72, 73-ish. Then they went out to California, and they were a big deal out there. It's a Los Angeles promotion. And then I think that was right before they made their initial trek to Florida. I was going to ask you, did they not have a program with the LeDuc brothers?
So in Florida, they didn't. They worked with them, but it wasn't an actual program. It was, and if it was, it was maybe a week or two. Like, they really weren't being a program with them. They did work. What was interesting back then, too, was they were running certain towns differently. So, like, Monday night in West Palm Beach, they were actually feuding with Don Morocco over a series of weeks, and Don would have a different partner, maybe Tony Charles one week or Danny Hodge another week. And then they would get to Miami and they would have a different set of opponents. But I want to say that they did work, albeit briefly, with them. It wasn't a big deal. It might have been Montreal that they actually worked with the LeDucs.
Yeah, that would make sense also. So
yeah.
But so anyway, so we do raise an adult beverage to the memory of Jerry Brown, one half of the original Hollywood Blondes. Rest in peace, sir.
So now, Barry, I know that you want to discuss one of your old friends. Oh, yes, folks, it's time to talk about Hannibal again. Hannibal has some merchandise for sale, right, Barry?
He does. But let me go back just a little bit before we get to that. So there, Jim Cornette. In the cult of Cornette, and they may have moved on from Hannibal, but I guess within the last couple of months, they really were all over Hannibal. And I think a lot of it had to do with just how bad his shoots were, not just from the standpoint that his delivery is super monotone and he's got, you know, the personality of a piece of paper, but the fact that he doesn't really do any prep for his interviews, that, you know, oh, you worked in Los Angeles. What's your favorite memory of a match in Los Angeles? Like, that's really the best you can come up with. So he's a terrible interviewer, but I got to say, Jeff, look, we've been on Hannibal. And when I say we've been on Hannibal, I mean figuratively. Exactly. We haven't literally been on top of Hannibal, because that wouldn't be the most comfortable thing. But we've been giving Hannibal a little shit, or a lot of shit, for probably the last year and a half. But with that being, I just want to point out that we were the originators, actually. But that was really the whole purpose of that. We were the first on that train. We were the trendsetters. But it did take Jim Cornette, in a sense, to kind of bring Hannibal down. And Hannibal has suffered greatly, where a year ago, and I think partly he's also not putting out a lot of new content, but I think the cult of Cornette is kind of really, really dug into Hannibal. And I know that his YouTube numbers are down significantly. You can look at the views. You can see it. He's not getting in. He's gotten really desperate, too, over like the last month or two with Jim Cornette especially. He got Rick Bassman, who was the guy who trained Sting and the Ultimate Warrior, to do a shoot talking about how Jim Cornette is a full of shit or something. And it, I mean, you know, really, you're going to get a guy that's been removed from professional wrestling for these amount of years to do a shoot to try to bring down Cornette. And then he was doing this, which I really thought was the ultimate in being pathetic. And that's right, I did say pathetic. When Cody Rhodes was the TNT champion, he was issuing a shoot challenge for Cody to bring him in. And I understand he was trying to get himself booked on national TV. Clearly, there is a reason Hannibal has never been on national TV, but I digress. But he did this over several weeks, where he was calling Cody out. Cody was a chicken. He wouldn't accept his challenge. Cody was not responding in any the guy's a fucking multi-millionaire at this point. He's an executive with AEW or don't like it. He's an executive with a top-rated wrestling show on the TNT network. He's not going to get involved in some sort of petty shoot fucking challenge deal with this guy in Canada, who's known for being a bully asshole. So I thought that was kind of funny. So I think Hannibal, and where I'm going with this, Hannibal is struggling. 6 months ago, when you and I were all over Hannibal, again, I mean that figuratively, you know, he was making a living from his YouTube channels. And I don't believe that's really the case. If he is making a living right now, it's pork and beans. He ain't dining with kings and queens anymore, Jeff. It's strictly pork and beans out of a can. So the act of desperation, take out the Cody thing, take everything else out. He's now selling merchandise. It's Hannibal merchandise. And as I noticed the other day, I looked at it and I popped, because I like laughed out loud with nobody else around me, like a pure psycho. He's selling a Hannibal fanny pack. Now, this is great on so many
perfect
levels.
Perfect in time for Christmas. Yeah.
Absolutely. Fanny packs, nothing screams 1986 NWA, where everybody in the NWA, even the WWF, they all had fanny packs. It was the deal.
Fanny packs, and they had the jeans tucked into their boots.
Or Zubas. It was one or the other. Yes. And it was – so he's released – and so how do you come up with the fanny pack idea – that I'm going to market a fanny pack with my name on it, Hannibal, to my YouTube crowd? Like, how do you place this order? I'd like to order. This is Hannibal. Hi, my name is Hannibal. I would like to order 5 fanny packs, please. I mean, who does he contact, and what is the standing order for these fanny packs? There's not going to be some fucking rush on these things. So when I saw it, I was just originally shocked. But apparently Hannibal now does have a merchandise store. So I expect very soon we'll be seeing Hannibal douchebags, which would be super appropriate. But, you know, he never ceases to bring himself down to what I see as like the lowest common denominator, whether it's trying to get himself booked for a show, selling some sort of merchandise, or creating this fake controversy, which he's done multiple times, so people will watch his YouTube videos because that's how he gets paid. It never ceases to amaze me, Jeff.
Yeah, he's big time. There's no question about it. So, you know, as I said, it's never too early to think about your Christmas shopping. And for those of you that are out there going, you know what I really like for Christmas, honey, is a fanny pack. Just give me a couple of weeks until I can figure out whose fanny pack I want. Holy shit, honey, I'm on Facebook and right here, Hannibal has fanny packs. I think we've got my Christmas shopping done, maybe.
Yeah.
So, Barry, had the chance the other night. I was a little delayed. I finally got around to watching Eddie Murphy and the Dolomite movie. This is something you had recommended to me quite a bit. And I have to say, I did not know the backstory about Rudy Ray Moore and Dolomite. I thought it was very entertaining. Some good cameos. I thought I told you, I thought the best scenes, for those of you out there that have seen the movie, I thought the best parts of the movie were the scenes between Eddie Murphy and the lady that play the woman that played Lady Reed. I don't know what the actress's name is, but you know, the quiet scenes, not the loud over the top scenes. Those were the best acted scenes, with the one where the woman is telling him, you know, women my size don't get a lot of opportunities to make movies. And, you know, I thought that was very effective. And, as I told you last night, Barry, I thought they were going to go romance with those two. They did not, which I was perfectly fine with, but I thought that's where they were heading. But, a fun movie. And, I ask you, Barry, was this movie anywhere close to the all-time Hollywood record for most curse words in a movie? Because, he does throw out there, I'm here to fuck a motherfucker up, at least 40 times. Yeah. In there, it's like a running joke that he says that. However, you have informed me that not only was this not any sort of Hollywood record breaker, this wasn't even close, Barry.
Yeah, so I think I remember we did the research on this probably going back. I know next week is our 3-year anniversary show, so maybe in the first year.
What?
Oh, yeah. Apparently next week is our it'll be episode 156, which is our third anniversary show, which is crazy, Jeff, that we've been doing.
It's great that Vince McMahon Jr. And Hulk Hogan will both be calling into the show maybe not.
Right. And actually, I don't know, Jeff, did you get the bouquet of flowers and the $100 gift card to Fogo de Chao from the great Brian Last like I did?
I haven't checked the mail today. Maybe. I want to say thank you to Brian for that. That's very thoughtful. You know, who doesn't love a good Fogo de Chao? You know,
ooh, that right about now would be excellent too. But no, it looks like Wolf of Wall Street fucking destroys everybody on the profanity scale. I always thought Midnight Run for some reason, because Robert De Niro must say fuck 8,000 times in that movie. But Wolf of Wall Street. But Jeff, I loved the Dolomite movie, and the reviews were so good for it when it first came out. And I think I watched it within a week or two of its release, and I really was just blown away and just taken. Eddie Murphy did a great job. He just did a tremendous job. You're 100% correct. You're absolutely correct about the scenes between the woman and himself. They were really heartfelt. It was and who was that? Who was the actress? Do we know?
While you keep talking, I will look it up.
All right, so I'll make small talk with this. So she really did a nice job too, and I think the scenes between the two of them took this movie to a different level, because Rudy Ray Moore was all about being over the top. He was outrageous, and this really humanized not only himself but the whole situation. So,
Divine Joy Randolph is her name.
I have no idea who she was, but boy, she did a great job.
Yeah, I was not familiar with her, but she absolutely did an outstanding job. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So Jeff, have you seen Cobra Kai yet?
I have not.
Are you a fan of the original Karate Kid?
I like the original Karate Kid. Not such a big fan of the sequels afterwards, but I've had more than one person say that Cobra Kai is very good. So that is on my wife and I's to watch list.
Yeah, Jeff, maybe my favorite thing I've watched since I watched Stranger Things. It really focuses on the first Karate Kid. So there's nothing to do with the second one, which was Okinawa, or the third one where he had the girlfriend and Kreese makes the return, but it's all different people. This is focusing literally on the first one. It's got Johnny. There's a scene, and I think it's in the second season. I binge watched the first and second season literally like back to back, but they actually get a large group of the Cobra Kai's together and they go camping. And it's a very something happens. I won't spoil it. It's a very powerful scene for a bunch of different reasons. But these guys have aged, Jeff, with the exception of Ralph Macchio and Johnny Lawrence, and Kreese, actually, everybody else has aged dramatically. You know, all these guys that had all this beautiful hair, you know how that is, Jeff. I know how that is.
It's what are you gone. To say? What are
you I'm trying to say it's all gone. The movie was filmed in 1983 and released in 84. So all those guys that had this million-dollar hair now are all, you know, shinier than my noggin. But really highly recommended. And I started watching last night on Netflix. Have you seen this show, Ratched?
No, I've never even heard of it.
So it's about Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
And Louise Fletcher, of course.
Oh, fantastic. But this isn't her. This is Sarah Paulson. And Sarah Paulson, known to many from American Horror Story. The show was also created, I believe, directed, written by Ryan Murphy that does American Horror Story. So I turned it on, and this is about her earlier years prior to winding up in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But this is the first 5 minutes, you're just blown away. You're just like, oh, my God. So I wound up watching the first two episodes, and I got to tell you, Jeff, yeah, you may want to run and watch this one too. Not as feel good as the Karate Kid is Cobra Kai, but it's
I thought you were going to say not as feel good as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
It has its moments. it's got its look. One Flew Over's got its moments, still, you know. But it's I would say right. It's certainly not a feel good movie towards the ending. So
yeah. So because I am nothing if not generous, I know Barry loves every single episode to have a lovely food related story as part of our podcast. And I reached out to him last night. I told him a story of what happened to the beloved Mrs. Baldwin and myself the other night. So we were watching, actually, truth be known, we were watching the Food Network, and we were watching Beat Bobby Filet, which is the show that was on there. And on one of the episodes we were watching, Bobby was making some roasted potatoes with some Parmesan cheese on top. They looked absolutely delicious. My wife turns to me and she says, you know what? We need to go to Maggiano's. We haven't been there in a while. And I got a hankering for some roasted potatoes with some Parmesan cheese on top. So we make the reservations for Maggiano's. Unfortunately, as I told Barry, no longer using Open Table, Barry. Why don't you tell the folks real quickly about what that's all about?
Yeah, so we so sometimes the big companies too, with Open Table, there are fees that are involved. And sometimes with the big companies, especially during the last 6 months where every penny counts, you know, we've seen so many restaurants go out of business, and this will continue over the next few months, because as bills mount up and people are still hesitant to go into restaurants, places will have to close their doors. But a lot of the bigger companies had to learn to look at the dollar and say, okay, how can we save money? And unfortunately, a lot of key players that were making big salaries have been released. But at the same time, they've decided to utilize their own reservation system. So meaning that you couldn't go to Open Table to make a reservation at Maggiano's. You'd have to go on their website, the Maggiano's website, or maybe their Facebook page and do it. And a lot of the bigger companies are having web developers actually create these apps. The one difference being, yes, you can make a reservation, but there's no network of diners. So, you know, people can go on to Open Table, and we see that most reservations being made for restaurants are being made directly from Open Table. But with whatever system Maggiano's is using, there is no platform per se. So you would have to go to Maggiano's website or their Facebook page, I'm assuming their Facebook page, in order to be able to make that reservation.
So what happens is we go there, my wife orders the chicken marsala and I order the chicken franchise. Okay. So our meal comes, my wife has her meal with the side of the roasted potatoes, nice and crispy. My meal comes all on one plate with the roasted potatoes not so nice and crispy because they're under the chicken with the marsala sauce, okay? So I called the waitress back and I said, hey, I said, you know, it's kind of come here for the reason of getting the crispy roasted potatoes. I said, now they're going to be kind of like basically eating mashed potatoes. I said, you know, can I get a separate order of that? Oh, sure, no problem. So she walks away and leaves. I begin having the chicken, which was fine. There was nothing wrong with the chicken. And she comes back, delivers me the separate plate of the roasted potatoes with the Parmesan cheese on top. I eat them. They're very good. We finish. We look. My wife is looking at the bill. And after she pays, she says, you know, I think they charge us separate for the roasted crispy potatoes that you got on the side. And I said, well, that's interesting because she didn't bother to tell us that there would be an extra fee for that. And now here's where my friend, Mr. Rose, former server, former restaurant manager, to explain to us why they didn't tell me.
Yeah, so it's funny. As you were telling me the story last night, you were about middle through it, and I was like, I already figured out what happened. I already knew the ending of this one. So what happened was Jeff got the chicken franchise with the crispy roasted potatoes. The potatoes are underneath the chicken. And then Jeff's wife, Kim Baudrin, and I got to say, when you told me about chicken franchise, Jeff, it's all I've been thinking of for 24 hours. Seriously, I haven't had that in years.
And it's healthy for you too, Barry. That's what's key.
Well, I don't know about that, but boy, it tastes really good, doesn't it? And if it's made right, and it's not the easiest thing to make, actually, when it's made right, it really is just an excellent dish. And Kim got the chicken marsala, but the potatoes were on the side. So the first thing in my head was the potatoes were on the side for Kim's dish because the marsala sauce is so heavy. It would completely overpower it. With you, underneath the chicken, the potato is picking up the flavor of the butter and the lemon, which is much, 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 much lighter. So that made sense to me. The next aspect was, in a lot of these big corporate restaurants, the server just can't go back to the chef and say, I need some new potatoes, give me new potatoes. They have procedures and protocols in place, so the server had to ring up a new order of potatoes. What happened was she forgot to go to the manager after the fact to get it voided off. And that's where I think you wound up seeing the extra charge, because I can't see a big corporation like Maggiano's charging you for an extra order of potatoes because you didn't like the first order. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So you also, what was the other thing you said? Oh, yes. You were relating it to a story that you had where you went to Chick-fil-A and they had messed up your order, and you suggested that I contact or send an email for the opportunity to get plentiful goods. Explain your Chick-fil-A story, Bear.
Yeah, so I don't want to say that I am looking for free stuff. It certainly doesn't hurt, but at the same time, I like Chick-fil-A. We have a Chick-fil-A that opened up from our house maybe within the next 5 minutes. So they've been open for 2 or 3 months. And my daughter just, you know, it's so close. It's head and shoulders above most other fast food. So we do go there frequently. So we had gone, and this was the third time, but we always order large. We don't go the medium. We go the large. And partly it's to get additional fries and additional soda. And they're filling up the large fry halfway. So it wasn't a one-off, but it was three times in a row where both of our orders of fries are only filled up halfway. So I said, you know what? I said, it better we take a photo, and then I'll email Chick-fil-A. And Chick-fil-A is known. Customer service is their thing. You know, In-N-Out Burger, Chick-fil-A. If we're looking at fast food in the United States, they're one and two when it comes to customer service. The customer's always right. My pleasure, yada, yada, yada. So I email them and I hear back in a few days. They apologize. They say that they're going to talk to the team members to make sure that everything is filled, you know, to the way it's supposed to be, to spec, whatever their spec is. And then they include like 5 meals and 5 additional orders of fries. Like, you know, we look at it. So I show Zoe and Zoe's like, oh my God, it pays off. And the truth is, I think I've only contacted restaurants maybe 5 times in my entire life. And only once, and I'll never forget it, did I not receive a response back, and that was Qdoba. which is a shithole, and I'll never go back to Qdoba. But
tell us what you really feel.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is. It's Qdoba to me is the low end of any of the Mexican, and
it's the Hannibal of Mexican restaurants.
It's the Hannibal, the fanny pack of the Mexican fast casual restaurants that I'll never go to. But like I contacted, I thought this was great years ago. We had an issue at Bonefish Grill, and I think I've relayed this story, so I won't go through it. But I got home and I was kind of like ticked off at something that had happened. And I shot an email to the manager. And I think within an hour on a Saturday night, the manager had called me. I mean, that's everything. There's the old saying in the restaurant business. It's not about the fuck up. It's about the recovery, because every restaurant will fuck up. And the ones who don't fuck up, Jeff, are lying to you. Every restaurant fucks up, but it's how you recover the situation. And as long as you make the diner feel valuable and important, the diner's going to come back. Works on me every time.
Yeah. So, okay. So as we're starting to wrap up the old episode this week, wanted to recognize a couple of birthdays. Who knew that on the same day, not the same year, but the same day, same birthdays, Jack Briscoe and Bill Murray. So Bill Murray, happy birthday. I know he's an avid listener here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowder and Barry. But I have a Jack Briscoe story or a question for you, Barry. The first time that Jack met Dory in Florida for the world title was, let's see, it was
July 30th, 1969. Yep.
Do you have any records to what the attendance might have been for that night?
I do. And here's even the cool thing, Jeff. So when you told me that you were going to be speaking of this, I pulled up my files. I actually have a photo of Jack versus Dory that was taken from the first ever match. And I don't know if anyone else has photos. And the reason I say that is this Miami Beach used to have its own wrestling program, unlike, you know, like Jerry Prater and the Grapevine, which hit every city in the state. In the 60s, Miami Beach had its own program, and it only lasted about a year, but that year was 1969. So every week they would put in photos of the matches from the previous week. So I've actually got at least one photo of Jack versus Dory, and it was a hell of a card. It was the first time that Jack and Dory had ever wrestled for the NWA title, and they had – it was a legendary feud. I'll say it was one of the great feuds of all time, especially in the territorial days. They went to a one-hour draw, but listen to the rest of the card that night. The great Malenko defeated beautiful Brutus. Beautiful Brutus was Bugsy McGraw before he became Bugsy. Louis Tillette defeated Vincent Lopez. Hans Mortier and Sam Steamboat, the father of Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Allegedly
wrestled to a draw. Mixed tag match. Dick Dunn and Celine Fontaine, she was a female little person, defeated Pee Wee Anderson and they don't mention – and Lopez. That's all she gets. So it's Pee-wee. I swear to God, I'm looking at it. Lopez. I'm looking at the newspaper article. So Lopez, whoever you were, you got fucked on this one. And then Cyclone Negro.
Another example of the promoters and the newspaper screwing the women wrestlers, I tell you. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, well, it happens again. Great job here. The Miami News on July 31st, the day after. Cyclone Negro combined with someone, and they don't say who, to defeat the Missouri Mauler and Hiro Matsuda. So nice job. But the important thing, Jeff, and what you were asking, what was the attendance this night at the convention hall?
Yes.
This was a really big attendance. We normally did somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000. There were times we were down to between 2,000 and 3,000. Between 3,000 and 4,000, sometimes the norm. This card, allegedly, according to the newspaper, 6,100 people in attendance that night.
Yeah, that's and that was a consistently, drawing program, Jack and Dory Jr. I mean, just not just in Florida. I was reading a story that was republished from Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, where they talked about how they took the program to Atlanta on the night of the Inoki Ali match for a pay-per-view show, I think, in Atlanta. And so they brought it to St. Louis. They brought it all over the country, and it drew everywhere because they knew that it was going to be the kind of a match that the promoters wanted to present to the fans.
Yeah, exactly, too. And that's, you know, that was the beauty of wrestling back in those days. And I think some of the indie shows, you see that you don't really see it so much on, you know, as far as I guess AEW last week with that parking lot brawl.
Oh, good Lord. Man,
yeah, which was... apparently Dave Meltzer gave it 5 stars. Is that correct?
I don't know. I haven't gotten the latest Observer. But yeah, I mean, that was just that was something, you know, those guys were feeling that match for a couple of days afterwards, because there was some just some brutal, brutal shit. That thing where he dropped through the windshield.
Oh, and, my God.
Yeah, that was just stuff. And then they were, you know, put the guy in the trunk and were slamming the trunk on him. That was some stuff that was tough to watch. So anyway, so but getting back to Jack Briscoe. So as I was reading it, and it was really a sort of going over Jack Briscoe's career, I wanted to touch on a couple things with you. So they were talking about when Dory was first put up for the world title. And of course, obviously, this would have been too soon for Jack to have been given consideration. But when Dory took over the world title from Gene Kaniski, who the different promoters were trying to push as a you know, potential replacement for Gene Kaniski. And of course, Dory Sr. had lots of stroke within that within that organization. So he was pushing very hard for his son. However, I did not realize that the guy that Eddie Graham pushed at that point for the world title, Hiro Matsuda.
Yeah. Where did you read that?
It was in the Briscoe obituary that was in it just came out. It was on Twitter. They republished it on Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's. I mean, I don't know. I should say I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's not true. It seems a little suspicious. Certainly, he was qualified from an in-ring perspective. Hiro in his prime, in his heyday, was one of the best ever. He had been part of the World Junior title situation with Danny Hodge for years. They had traded the title back and forth, and into the 60s, into the 70s, they were trading the title back and forth. I don't know Hiro's English. I don't want to say it was limited, but he certainly, if you ever saw his interviews, he never really talked a whole lot. So I don't know how that would have worked out. But I was always under the impression that it was from 69 on, it was Jack Briscoe, that Jack Briscoe was the guy. And certainly, you know, Jack Briscoe only came to Florida in 1968. So within a year of Jack Briscoe arriving in Florida, with only a couple of years underneath his belt, he is in the main event working a one-hour draw with the world's heavyweight champion, which really says it's exactly what they thought of Jack. And we know that, you know, that Jack was Eddie's boy. Mike Graham might have been his son, but at the same time, Jack was Eddie's boy, and Jack did everything that Eddie wanted at that stage. And Eddie obviously was firmly in the corner of making Jack the world's heavyweight champion. And I think to some degree, I wonder what the relationship was like between Dory Sr. and Eddie Graham, based off of, Dory not wanting to lose the title to Jack, or whether Dory Sr. not wanting Dory Jr. to lose the title, because Dory Sr. and Eddie go way back. They go back to the 50s in Texas. And a lot of what Eddie Graham learned as a wrestling promoter, he learned from Dory. A lot of that Florida Sheriff's Boys Ranch stuff that Dory Sr. had been doing in Texas for years. So I always wondered if that really hurt the relationship between the two. We did see Dory. I want to say the last time we saw Dory Sr., 72, I think. He came down and worked, but he was in and out, you know, in the early 70s, passed away in 73. But going back to your original point, this was the feud that I think if you wanted to see professional wrestling, this was what you saw. And that was the beauty of Florida, is one match, you're going to have this great, amazing athletic contest between Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. And then the next match might be a brass knuckles Texas barbed wire match or something like that with Dusty Rhodes. So you're going to get this scientific wrestling style. And then the next match is going to be a bloodbath or something like that.
Yeah. So last question, and then we got to wrap the episode up. A point that was also made was they were discussing Jack Briscoe versus Billy Robinson, who I know are two huge favorites of yours. Personally,
oh, yeah.
The comment that was made was Jack, when he was in the ring, was there to make the match better. Billy Robinson, when he was in the ring, was there to show the fans
how great a wrestler he was. Would you agree with that?
I won't disagree with it. I'm not sure. It's hard for me to say. I could see that, though. I mean, I guess if I start to, I've never heard that before. If I start to break it down, I will say with Jack Briscoe, and I guess so. I with Jack Briscoe, his matches were always good. Even you remember that match that we reviewed almost 3 years ago, when it was the Briscoe brothers versus Adonis and Murdoch. And terrific, that's one of Jack's.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's one of his last matches of his career. Yeah. I mean, that was just that's like the 20-year career, and that's about the end of it right there. And that match is still terrific. With Billy Robinson, I guess in a sense, because I walk away and I say, I'm really impressed with what Robinson does in the ring. Like, I've never seen that. But I don't walk away and say, that was the best match I ever saw. So, yeah, who came up with that?
Again, it was in the same Briscoe obituary. I don't know who it was that made the comment that Dave replied. It was somebody that made a comment. I'll have to check it.
That's a great observation, though, and yeah. It's going to cause me to think, but there may be a lot of truth to that, yeah.
Yeah, so all right. So as we're wrapping up the episode now, I would remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, on behalf of my co-host Barry Rose and our producer, the sweet man Lou Kippelman, says it's clearing up a little bit out in Frisco. The bad air is finally going away. That's good to hear. And I will just remind you, next week, our 3-year anniversary. It's a special, and I don't want to say the entire show. There'll be some awards given out, Barry. Is that safe to say?
That's probably pretty safe to say. Lou, is that safe to say that we're going to be giving out awards next week? What do we call these awards, Lou?
We call them... Pardon me.
Oh, my.
It's the first ever Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry Kayfabe Awards.
Yes, the Kayfabe Awards. The awards dinner will be held at Chili's, and we're going to have Michael Scott moderating it.
I thought it was the International Beer Garden.
Yes, well, that's where we're going. In beautiful downtown Lutz, Florida, or wherever it is. See if we can get rousted by the bartender and a couple of the waitresses. So until next week, folks, we appreciate you listening, and we will see you next week for the Kayfabe Awards.